Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
What? Welcome to Rahalastapa. It's another one for you, my fine friends. And this week we have the wonderful Bethany Black. Very funny, but also covering some pretty serious and issues and some very honest stuff from Bethany, who is a fantastic comedian. I hope you will check her out if you haven't seen her before. Do bear in mind, you can become a badger. Go to gofasterstrike.com/badges. Your £3 or more a month will help us make loads more podcasts, but also get you loads of benefits, including knowing the guests for the shows in advance, which was a benefit for anyone who wants to see the Michael Palin one, who wants to see the Adam and Joe one, which sold out before we could even announce that to anybody else. But you also get backstage videos, you get the audio podcast ad-free and a day before everyone else, you get a secret email every month, you get entered into a prize draw, you get all sorts of other backstage videos and stuff, extra videos, not just the backstage ones, so like the Stone Clearing podcast and snooker tournaments, but there's going to be loads of new other stuff put up in there as well. And some of my stand-up shows as well. You'll be able to see all of those if you stick with us for a while. And your £3 will be just ploughed back into making more podcasts, because I am crazy and I don't like having money myself. We are hoping to make a podcast of my sci-fi sitcom, which is called Everything Happens for No Reason. And hopefully that will happen in late 2020 or early 2021, depending how long it takes to write it and secure the cast, because I'm hoping to get the cast we had for the Channel 4 taster tape that Channel 4 foolishly turned down. They will learn their lesson, my fan friends. So anyway, let's sit back, relax, and enjoy the remarkable Bethany Black on Rahalastapa. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Stoller Halls in Manchester. We liked it so much we came back for a second week, even though it's a weird lecture theatre and not good for podcasts. Please welcome a man who is going to stage dive all the way through this show. It's Richard Herring! Oh yeah! Gonna kill me last year. It's a lovely venue. I don't know why I said that. It's a beautiful venue. Welcome to that's it. Richard Herring's Limp Swedes and Turnips podcast. It's hard to come up with these. So hard to come up with these.
Not very good, but it's the best I could do. I did that in the services on the way here, that one. Thought that'll do. It's a podcast about just various tubers that aren't as hard as you'd expect them to be. But I was hanging out at Canal Street the other day. It was hard to find because someone had taken all the C's and S's off the signs. And not even a joke, it's just true. I was in Vanilla, where I proved to be equally popular with the ladies as in any other bar in the world. Anyway, they call it Rahalastapa, so I don't know that's going to catch you. I also popped down to Coronation Street. Someone had removed all the C's and S's from that as well. Oronation Treat, it's not as funny, is it? It nearly is. Weirdly, it nearly works. It's lovely to be back in Manchester. I was on a magic bus the other day in Manchester. You've got the magic buses. Hope you still got those. They're literally magic. You get on, you close your eyes, and when you open them again, you're where you wanted to go. It's a magic bus, and also you're covered in sick and bits of kebab. And your wallet's magically disappeared as well, because you're in Manchester. So all I've got, that is literally all I've got for you. So I'm going to welcome your guests. I called you wankers last week. I called you thieves this week. And that is all you're going to get. I love you, Manchester. My mum and dad didn't meet here, but they both came to university here. So in a way, I'm a Mancunian in a way. That's right. One of the Mancunians. Hey, all right. How you guys speak. So, my guest this week is probably best known for her appearance on The Chase. She also played Pocahontas in No Offence, which I'm really excited about as well. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Bethany Black! Sit down, there's microphones, we've got everything.
Oh, this is nice. So this is where you live, then?
This is my little house.
This is your house. Yeah, this is fantastic. I like these were just different enough from the Tyne Tees and Yorkshire Television symbols of the 70s to not get sued.
That's right.
I think that's fantastic.
Now you've pointed it out, they will get sued. That's the end of the Manchester Podcast Festival. Let's talk about The Chase. You went on The Chase.
I did go on The Chase,
I love The Chase.
I love The Chase as well. I it's one of those things that I'd like to binge watch. Yes. I will save up like 3 weeks worth. And then just watch them like one after another. I'd sit there with my girlfriend watching it every day, and she'd go, and I'd go, oh, I should go on one of these. And she went, well, you should. And I went, well, in which case I will. And then I applied, and I turned up and I did the audition thing. And at the end of it, they said, do you know any of the Chasers? And I went, yeah, I know Paul Sinha, because he's a comedian. We've worked together for years. And I know Jen Ryan off Twitter.
Yeah.
And they went, oh, right, okay. So, and they did a bit of background check, and they went, oh, we best check whether or not you're too famous to go on the regular Chase. And I was like, please, I really want to be not famous enough so that I can keep the money if I win.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm definitely going to beat them, and hopefully everyone else on my team will get kicked out so I get to keep it all to myself. And then they phoned me back a week later, and they went, good news, you're not famous enough.
The worst thing would be if you were, you were too famous to go on the civilian one, but not famous enough.
Yeah, I was
just
right
in the hinterland.
Oh, yeah.
To think it's where I am. how did you get on The Chase?
I did all right. I managed to beat. I beat the beast. Mm. Which not a euphemism. And I went for the higher offer. Yeah. I managed to come back to my team with £42,000. Because I'm really smart, and unfortunately, no one else on my team was. So, so when we got to the final round, because the other thing is, I'm the unluckiest person that you've ever met. Like, genuinely, this is just like today. I opened a Lemsip and it didn't actually have any Lemsip in the sachet. Like, that is the level of bad luck that I tend to have. And I went on this, and like we did really well in that, and the rest of my teammates went, well, you've got to pick the final questions. You've got to pick the final, because they come out with a little velvet bag with two like ping pong balls in it,
right.
Which, yeah, and you, I know exactly, and like you can't expect someone as filthy as me to just sort of stand there and wait for that thing to just happen and move on from. But they went right out, and everyone on my team was going, well, you need to pick, and I was like, well, I can't pick because I'm the unluckiest. But if I pick, we will get a set of questions where I can't answer a single one of them. And they went, no, you've been really lucky so far. And I was like, not luck. knew all of the answers. And they still made me pick, and exactly as I said would happen, happened. And I got, like, the first 10 questions of it. I had no idea, like, what any of them were. Yeah. So I was really angry. I came home after that, just sort of like...
So I'm taking it you didn't win the jackpot.
Win the jackpot, no.
Think of all that money. How many people would you have had to share it with?
I'd have had to share it with 3 people, so it would, right. I would have come away with about... I figured it out. I would have come away with £18,000, which would have been enough to not be in debt.
It's a cruel show. They try really hard to make you not win it.
Yeah, they really, really do. They really try and make you feel intimidated as well. And, like, you don't meet the chaser other than they just arrive at the top of the set and they sit there and you go, right, okay, you're not going to talk to any of us, because obviously they can't do that, because then there'd be accusations, because there's already accusations. No matter who you are, whenever you're on TV, whenever you do anything, there are always people at home and more so now on Twitter, who think that whatever it is you've said or done is absolutely a lie. That everything's a fix. It was like that thing of people saying, I've seen her on the telly before. And it was exactly, it was I have been, but this is, I've got the shittest level of celebrity that it's possible to have, in that about once a month somebody will go, what have I seen you in? And I'll list everything and they'll go, no. Okay.
Well, let's talk about some of your TV appearances. Let's get straight into what my audience want to talk about. We might talk about.
All right then. No offence, is it?
It's not no offence. It is a doctor. Doctor Who.
I was in Doctor Who.
You played a cloned warrior.
I did. Yeah.
Is it cheating to have sex with a cloned warrior? Is my first question.
No, I honestly don't think it is. I've been thinking about this far more than I should have done.
If you're in a relationship with the warrior, who the cloned warrior, is the cloned warrior cloned from a warrior, or are they cloned from a regular person just turned into a warrior?
I think that they were cloned. I think they were genetically modified. Okay. That was the thing behind
the
character. I ended up one of the weirder moments in my life was being sat in a place in a recording studio in Soho with Mark Gatiss, going, well, if this episode goes really well, then we'll come back. So we just spent about 2 hours going through so much stuff about the backstory of the character in case they decided to have a whole army of me. And then the episode came out and over half of the fans thought it was the worst episode of Doctor Who that had ever been recorded. And so I'm not going to be back in it. But I could be if enough of you...
You're a big Doctor Who fan before,
massive
right?
Doctor
to
Who
the
fan.
Extent
yeah, yeah.
You said to Mark Gatiss something about this is set in the same century as another episode.
It was set in the same century. It was set in the 27th century, and it's set on a moon just off Pluto, which is where the Sunmakers episode was set.
Of course.
Yeah, of course. Everyone knows that. Yeah. I'm not as much of a fan of it as Toby Haydock, right? So put it that way. It was just lucky I'd happened to be watching The Sunmakers that weekend.
Right.
And went, this all ties up. And there were some prop designs that were similar. The guns that we used looked like the guns from The Sunmakers as well, only with a bit more cash thrown at them because it's not 1973. It was just a coincidence, apparently. Yeah. I don't know whether it was in terms of the set design, because those guys are... worse than Toby.
Yeah.
Worse than Toby Haydock when it comes to these sorts of things. I think he's done one of your podcasts.
He did the Manchester Podcast Festival last year.
And he knows every single actor, every single extra, every single crew member who has worked on every single Doctor Who episode ever. And
he's a nut.
Yeah, he is.
I couldn't say it at the time. He's a fucking idiot and a nut. What a nutty idiot.
He's a very nutty idiot.
He ends up rewrites obituaries for all these. He meets all these actors and gets to know them, and then writes all their obituaries.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's worked out pretty well for him. He's making a probably £150 a pop on those.
Yeah. And that's it. And because he does the Who's Round podcast where he goes and talks to them.
Yeah.
And almost everybody he's talked to has now died. Yeah. And it was I think they'd had 3 in 1 week. And the day after the third one, he went, do you want to come and do my podcast? I don't think I can risk that, Toby.
So, what was the experience like as a fan getting to be in Doctor Who? I mean, that must could.
You could
well, I mean, were you able to?
It's a double-edged sword. It's real double-edged sword. Yeah. To be honest, like this. I mean, it's like spending 3 weeks doing a really boring live-action role play of Doctor Who, is what it is. And it's because you've got so much time when you're not allowed to be around other people. Well, because I had like a full face tattoo in the episode, because some of you were sat there going, I've seen every episode of Doctor Who and you don't recognise me. I had a full face tattoo, which technically counted as a spoiler, so I wasn't allowed to go and sit in the BBC canteen with everyone else.
Oh.
In case extras from Casualty took photographs of me, because they filmed Casualty in the studio next door. So I just had to go and like sit in my trailer for like the first 2 weeks, and then it overran, so we ended up shooting at the same time as they were doing the finale. So at least on the final week, I got to go and sit off with a bunch of Time Lords.
Right.
It was great fun. It was lovely.
Which ones? Peter Capaldi was the doctor.
Peter Capaldi was the doctor in the.
And then
who
else did you meet?
Jenna Coleman.
Right.
And she didn't like me very much, and I think that's because I accidentally burped Red Bull in her face at the read through.
I've heard that about her.
Yeah, she's one chance Coleman. That's what they call her. And Reese Shearsmith was also in the episode, and it was really good. It was like, do you know, it's one of those, because you recognise when you're doing it that if you're a massive Doctor Who fan that this is probably going to be the peak of your life and nothing is ever going to be as good again, and it kind of ruins it a bit. But it does. But it was, you know, and they were really long days, and you know what it's like when you're filming. Like when you're filming these
I can
things,
vaguely
like,
remember. Yeah.
I was like, for that especially, because like I had to have this makeup, and rather than paint it on, which would have taken like what 20 minutes maybe, they made that I had to go in and have like one of those full head cast things that they do, like with like a dental putty.
Right.
Where they go and do that, and as I went in, they went, listen, like some people panic when they've got their face covered with this and you can't breathe, so you know, and because obviously you can't talk. I was like, oh, don't worry. And they're like, no, you might freak out. And I was like, more likely I'll get turned on. But and they went, no, you'd be okay. And then they all took photographs, all stood around me whilst I had this thing on my face and I couldn't see anything. So they did that so that they could go and make a silicone tattoo that they could then go and put over the top of it. So instead of it being sort of like painted on,
yeah.
I had to go in 2 hours early. So they could go and spend 2 hours just painstakingly sticking this little tattoo to my face. And at the end of the day, the stuff that they have to remove, the prosthetic stuff in the makeup van, is for much thicker prosthetics, so it didn't actually work. All it did was take the colour out of it and leave me with sticky silicone all over my face. Mm-hmm. So I ended up having to wash it off. So it took an hour and a half at the end of each day to take off. So it's already a 12-hour shooting day, and then I've got an extra 3 hours on top of that. So it was just I was just asleep or stood around waiting to do the episode. And I'm so glad that everyone liked it as a result of that.
I thought it was a good one. I watched that one.
I really enjoyed it. Like, and because I've managed to get enough distance from it when I actually watched it. And one of my favourite things about it is that now, every year on my birthday's Christmas Eve, so nearly Jesus. And and so every year on my birthday, the Doctor Who Online Twitter account wishes me a happy birthday, because I'm like, I don't think there's anyone else who's been in Doctor Who with a Christmas Eve birthday. Toby will be sat at home right now getting fucking furious, going, there are seven other actors and three extras. And so they always go, happy birthday to Bethany Black, which then means I get an hour and a half of like the angriest nerds on Twitter all telling me how much they hated the episode and how I ruined the show for them. And it's just the best birthday present I could ever ask for.
Doctor Who fans are a special breed of people. I mean, I did an audio thing for them years ago, yeah. And then I went along to some signings for that. And I kind of admire how dedicated they are to the show, and how just they know what they like, and they're not embarrassed about it at all. Nor should they be, but they're not. But they should be. But then they're grown men, grow up. But nearly all men.
Say that, but I once spent an evening with the Derby Doctor Who Society. When I was giving to, because I was Toby Haydock's driver when he did a show about Doctor Who.
Right.
So he was fucking furious when I got cast in it. He was like, what, it's like 30 years I've been into it and they cast my fucking driver. And I'll tell you, I have never felt more attractive than the evening I spent with the Derby Doctor Who Society.
The Derby ones are the ugliest. Everyone knows that. Yeah. Everyone knows that about the Derby.
We've seen Derby. We know what it's like.
So we'll talk a bit more about acting, I think, later on. But let's get into how you got into stand-up. What was the impetus to get into stand-up? Because you...
Right, I'd failed at everything else.
Right.
I think that's the usual way to go, isn't it? You know, a failure at everything else, and a pathological need to be liked by people, and an inability to really enjoy anything.
What were you doing before?
What I'd done is I wanted to act like when I was a kid, and then I met performing arts students, and that really put me off. And so I went off to college and I studied film and television. I was going to get into writing, and I'd spent ages trying to get a film made, and that wasn't working. And I ended up doing data entry. I ended up having to log all of the holes in Liverpool, all of the holes in the street in Liverpool. This was the data entry job that I had. I had to go and turn the paper, the things that the surveyors had gone and written. They'd written it all down on these sheets. And then we had to go and computerize them, and I had to go and put in exactly where they were logged in the thing. And I was in a place in Blackburn, which was perfect, measuring all of the holes in Liverpool in Blackburn. And so I ended up, and I just remember being sat there just going, well, is this my life now? Is this what I have to do? I need to get out of here and do some stand-up. And that was the last thing that I sort of had. I went, it can't be worse than doing this, can it? And then one of my friends said, we run a rock night and we want somebody to go on between the bands and do stand-up. And I went, yeah, all right, I'll give that a go. And then tried to write a set and wrote... I think I must have written about an hour's worth of material, of which I got one laugh out of the time. All of these people going, what the fuck are you doing? We're here to watch rock.
Yeah, and the hardest place to do comedy is anything with music around.
Yeah, it really is. And that was sort of the thing that then I was like, right, okay, once I got that one laugh, I was like, I think I can probably get more. I think I can figure out how I do this. And that was the thing that sort of got me onto that and giving up on everything else in my life.
I read somewhere that you felt you were too young to get into stand-up, but then you saw Josie Long.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's also true. Yeah, because I spent so much time going, I really wanted to do... Because it was that thing of wanting to do stand-up, because I was such a comedy nerd when I was a kid. I was, just old enough to remember the sort of... I used to sneak downstairs and watch the young ones through the crack in the door and all of that stuff, and Fist of Fun and, all of...
That was a bit later.
Yeah, I was at college when Fist of Fun came out, and we just would go around shouting about jelly and calling things flighty. And just such a massive comedy nerd, and always thought that the people on TV were about 10 years older than I was at the time. Yeah, I thought they were all in their 30s and 40s, but I'm far too young to do that. And I remember listening to the BBC, it was the BBC stand-up competition that they have every year. Yeah. And one year, Josie Long had won. And I realised that she was 4 years younger than me. And I went, right, okay, well, I'm old enough then, definitely. And that was the thing that sort of gave me the impetus to to go, actually, I can probably do this. And then at the same time, having a string of shitty jobs. I got fired from 14 day jobs in a single year.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, that's when you go, do you know what? Maybe I'm the cunt. maybe it isn't them. And I genuinely, I did. I got fired from all of those. And one of them, the one that made me go, right, I absolutely have to make a living at stand-up, was I was working for a credit card company. In a call centre, and my boss, that was literally that thing of the boss going, if you worked hard, you could have my job in the next 5 years. And I walked out and just never came back. I can't think of anything worse. You couldn't have, and that was it. And after that, it was just, I then went back to college. I went back to university to get the student loan so that I could go off and do stand-up.
Right.
And do the bare minimum. I was like, oh, what's the easiest thing I could do for a degree? Cultural studies. That sounds dead easy. Let's do that. So I did that. And unfortunately, it's meant that I learned how to predict all of the horrible shit that we've currently got going on.
Okay.
I mean, sorry, you're 4 months in the future, aren't you?
You should know what it is.
In this fantastic communist paradise of the Democratic People's Republic of the island of the UK. Good. So I Yeah, just really loved stand-up more than anything else, and then accidentally fell into acting. Like, and this is the thing, because everyone always, basically, I'd never particularly successful at stand-up. Like, I love it, and I've got really good at it recently, but for a very long time, I would go on stage and just upset people. I don't know whether it was just my mere presence. A lot of the time, like for the first couple of years, I was desperately trying to like come up with anything that I thought was funny, and was only ever funny by accident, and then realised, oh right, oh that bit was funny, and that bit was, and it took a long time to learn how to do what I do, and just spent so much time doing that and really, really struggling with it, and just being at that point where you're just about making enough money to do it, and having too many gigs to actually get a real job. But not enough gigs to sort of get on with your life in any real enjoyable way. And I was like really, really struggling at it. And then I just sort of managed to break that the back of that and started to get enough work. And then I broke my leg in the middle of what was like the most... Already, this was like the end of the unluckiest year that I'd ever had. I got dumped just before I was supposed to be getting married. And it just got worse from there. I ended up having to move back in with a group of comedians. Flat sharing with comedians when you're in your mid-30s is... it was awful. I nearly bled to death in the shower. That was a weird one. I managed to knock a toothbrush mug over. Like I told you I was the unluckiest person. Knock a toothbrush mug over, which then severed a vein in my ankle, and I nearly bled out. This was like 2 days after Christmas. This was on my 33rd birthday, right? And I'd like, again, Christmas Eve, nearly Jesus, got to 33 and went, fuck it, I've just got to make it past Boxing Day. Got to make it past Good Friday and I'm golden, right? Yeah. And then 2 days later, hubris caught up with me and I nearly bled to death in a shower. And because I remember just like dropping the glass into the shower, looking down and going, oh, it didn't cut me. And then getting out and looking down and went, oh, fuck, no, it did. And then knocking on my flatmate's door who answered it, and I was sort of stood there with a towel and just I think I've hurt myself. Because I looked around for anything to sort of stop the bleeding. There were two little, like, Q-tip type cotton buds in there. And that is not going to work. Knocked on the door, and he's just like, you all right? I think I've hurt myself. And then just collapsed and dropped the towel and had everyone in my flat scurrying around to sort of, like, resuscitate me. And, like, it's the most embarrassing thing, being rescued naked on your own landing. I have no idea why they were naked. But I... If anything, it was awkward. get out of the face. And so it's just like I had a long run in that year of just like really, really bad things. And then at the end of it all, then I broke my leg and then couldn't work for 18 months because I couldn't walk. Because, again, the unluckiest person in the world, I developed an allergy to the metal that they'd used to fix my leg with. Because who has a titanium allergy? And so I couldn't walk properly. And so we ended up, like, I met my partner sort of, like, during that time. So, you know, things got even worse. And, we'd reached the point where, I couldn't afford to pay the rent. I'd run up massive amounts of debt. And I'd phoned up the Citizens Advice Bureau to sort of go, like, how do you declare bankruptcy? Like, because I guess you can't just go into your bank and you go, I'm bankrupt. Like, it doesn't work like that. And they said, you need to fill in some forms and there's a £512 fee. And I went, what? To declare bankruptcy? They're like, yeah, it's 500. I was like, well, I haven't got that. And they went, well, could you not borrow it? So that's how I got in this mess. And who are you going to ask? Like, basically, who are you going to ask to borrow £512 to declare bankruptcy? What do you need it for? So I can get a bit of paper that says I don't owe you anything. Like, that's... Isn't that how this is going to work? And so I'd phone them up, put the phone down, and was just sort of sat there on my bed going, well, this is, I don't even know what to do. I'm not even rich enough to declare bankruptcy. Like, I'm absolutely screwed. And three of my friends had gone and sent me, messages on Facebook saying, you need to audition for this role. And, like, as a comedian, I'd often get things from people saying, oh, I've got an open casting for this. This one sounds like you. You should go for this. And three people had sent it to me. And I remember your rule. Three people tell you that to do something, you have to do it. And they all said, you should audition. You should go for this audition. And I did. I emailed them immediately. It was for Cucumber for Russell T Davies. Yeah. And I emailed them there and then. It was, like, the Monday afternoon. I got the audition on the Thursday. Did the audition. Andy Pryor, the casting director for that and for Doctor Who, phoned me on the Saturday and said, can you come back in for a call back on Tuesday? Went in on the Tuesday. That evening, I got a phone call telling me I got the role. 2 days after that, we did the read-through. And 3 days after that, we started filming. And so my life just turned around immediately.
Amazing.
And like on the read-through, when I arrived, he said, oh, don't be worried about the read-through. I know you'll be nervous. And I was like, I had no idea you were supposed to be nervous because I'm a stand-up, and being sat in a room with a bunch of other people with the words in front of you that you've got to say seems seems a little bit too easy, if you ask me. And he said, well, don't worry. It's like, do you know what happens at a read-through? And I said, I've seen enough Doctor Who Confidential to know what happens at a read-through. And they went, he said, you're a Doctor Who fan? I said, yes, I am. And he went, I cast that, and I pretended I didn't know. And went, oh, really? And he said, yeah, would you like to be in it? And I went, yes, please. And I was like, well, this is day one as an actor. This is a piece of piss. Can't really get any easier than that. And yeah, and that was kind of, and it was like, it was about 18 months later when he got in touch and said, do you want to do Doctor Who? Yeah. And that was fantastic as well. I mean, it was, like I said, it was really difficult. And my partner was there, and one day she came down for a set visit, and it was a really tough episode to film because it was all sort of like point of view shots.
Yeah.
So it was constantly just sort of like, so you also, as well as acting and remembering what you had to say and where you had to be, you also had to be aware of exactly how it was going to look when the camera was from your perspective. Okay. So you needed to make sure. So it just added an extra level of difficulty to it. So everybody's tempers were frayed. Yes. Everybody was really, really struggling, and we'd spent all day trying to get this one shot with, and it was only me, Peter and Jenna on the set by this point, and we've been trying to get this shot, and it was really, really difficult to get. And like, I think it was like take like 12 or 13 of it, and somebody walked through my eye line, and I nearly went full Christian Bale, sort of, fuck, do you think you'd get out my eye? And I realised that it was David Tennant, who'd arrived on a set visit, and like, I just suddenly went really like, you're my favourite doctor. Sorry, Peter. And it was the strangest thing, and just watching those two interact, and then Russell was there as well. So, you know, two doctors and a showrunner, it's like,
yeah,
you know, being a Catholic and meeting two popes and God, isn't it? You know? And Peter said to David, like, did you ever get to have a go on my TARDIS? And he said, no, I didn't. He said, would you like to? And I was like, holy shit, this can't get any better. And he went, yes, please. He said, well, let me take you up to the TARDIS then. And we walked round, and the set's like on three floors. So we walked up the stairs on the outside, got to the door, and he opened the main TARDIS door and went, come aboard. And you only get one chance. You've got to not fuck it up. So when you go in, you've got to go... it's bigger! I fucking nailed it as well. Like, absolutely spot on. And we were messing around. We were like, all of us just spent like the next 20 minutes just messing about on the TARDIS console.
Was the director annoyed that you disappeared to play in the TARDIS for the afternoon when you were in the middle of
it? No, he was all right with it, actually. He was just like, no, I've had enough of this. I've had enough of you pricks. I'm going off somewhere else. Yeah, no, he was absolutely fine with it. Yeah. It was, I think it was like the end of the Friday afternoon. So it was,
Just messing around. Sure. Lad bringing games.
It was already overdue. It had already gone over right. Budget and over like schedule by about a week.
Cool.
Life is full of what ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? United Healthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
So with the stand-up, though, you've when? How long before you did, like, you did an Ed, was your Ed Beth Becomes Her?
Beth Becomes Her was my first Edinburgh show. Yeah, that was, that would have been 9 years ago. Because I realised the other day, it was like, it was 2008 I did that. Because it was, it was the end of October 2007 was the first time I did that show live. Right. And that was my first hour show. And I did that at Vanilla, as mentioned. Because I used to run a comedy night there. And it was like, it was one of those things where everybody who performed there is now far more famous and successful than me. And it was like, I've got this thing, so I'll be able to use this as a vehicle. And like, the people we had playing there, Joe Lycett had his first ever gig there. Yeah. Sarah Millican was on there, Gary Delaney, Paul Sinhard. There's just like so many of them who've just like gone on and like, all right, okay. But... Yeah, that was my first show about 12 years ago now. Fucking hell, I'm getting old.
I mean, out of all the, you've got a lot of things to talk about in your life.
I do.
Most comedians have like one of the things that you have, and you've got all of them.
I've got all of them. I've just been really greedy, and I've ruined it. I've got all sorts of things. Yeah, because that first show was my coming out show, which is about being trans, which I assume you all are. Because you all look it, so don't worry. Not one of you looks like you're cisgendered, and that's you've done well there. Yeah, good. You know how bad some of them look. I just think, what's the point? I'm trans, and that show was because I thought, like, initially I was like, well, this is a good USP. I mean, not like initially when I came out as trans. Yeah. When I did the show, that wasn't like.
I mean, some comedians. Would
Everyone
think...
needs a gimmick.
Some comedians would go, I think this is worth it for the for the press. I'll
get. Mentioning Will Franken, and do you know what? So the show was all about that. It was all about coming out and my family's reaction to that, because that was the thing that was so difficult about it, because like coming out as trans, like in the end of the 90s, was a very different place to sort of like come out than it is now. And it was very, very difficult and very, absolutely terrifying to do that. And so I'd had and like lots of people when they come out, I had this whole idea of how I would react to anything. And everybody was just fucking blasé about it. And it was just ruined it. Like, I had absolutely nothing to fight against whatsoever. None of my family disowned me. It was awful. Like, you don't know how difficult that is when you're going, I've got an Edinburgh show to write. Come on, one of you pricks has got to say something really upsetting. And they genuinely didn't. I mean, the weirdest one was my uncle, who I absolutely loved to pieces, who's like desperate. It's like he's been a lorry driver for his entire life. When I try and describe my family, I always end up sounding like a 17th century urchin. Because my dad was a blacksmith. And he met my mum. He was a blacksmith's apprentice when he met my mum. And she was... she sold cockles in pubs. Genuinely true. And she had gone into the pub that his parents had owned. And he'd said, "Have you got crabs, love?" And it was her first day, so she'd never heard that before. And she thought, he seems nice. My parents had like retrained and gone off. My dad retrained to become a teacher. My mum eventually went off to college and retrained and became a probation officer. My dad's side of the family, like old working class like family from all over the place. But my uncle was a lorry driver, and everyone was like a little bit, maybe he might be a bit weird. And my grandma, who was a bit sort of Peggy Mitchell over the whole thing, was like, if he steps out of line, I'll have words with him. I'll give him shit, And my grandma organised, I am assuming, the first gender reveal party of of all time. And like invited everyone over. And like at one point he came over to chat to me and he went, listen, they all think I'm a bit weird. And they were worried. Like I know that they thought I might be a bit off with you, but I just want you to know I've been a long distance lorry driver for 30 years, so I have seen things. I went, all right. He said, yeah, there's a guy I know in Belgium, right, who wears a cardigan. And that was like his step into this other world. It was like, It's like, oh, so you knew you'd be okay with me. That's good. Right, this is fun. So yeah, that was my first show, and it's like, yeah, because on top of that, like, yeah, it's weird because I'm autistic as well, which you've probably noticed, and I have ADHD, and I have quite a lot of mental health problems, partly as a result of all three of those things. Like, I don't go out other than to go to work.
You're agoraphobic.
I've got like problems, and I didn't realise that I had agoraphobia either. That was like one of those things. Like, when my therapist told me that, I was like, no. Yeah, I do. Because it was like, initially she said, yeah, because of the agoraphobia. And I went, what are you talking about? That's like, you know, like in this 90s sitcom Game On, where you're a mad fantasist who never leaves your house. Or, you know, like the Sigourney Weaver movie, Copycat, where you just go and, like, spend your life on the internet. Oh, yeah, no, that is me, isn't it? That is who I am. Yeah, and a lot of that comes down to a combination of ADHD and autism, and also being trans and being terrified. Because the amount of shit that I get online, everyone hates me.
Yeah.
I get it from all angles. It's...
Well, it's...
Right across the political spectrum. It's wonderful.
Well, it's interesting because I think it's like you say, you came out very, very early as trans. Yeah. Like I remember the 80s and 90s. I remember what the attitudes of people were like. I guess you see it in comedy as well. It was just like even up into the 2000s, really. People were just, this is funny. Someone is a different sex or wants to be a different sex than they are. How funny is that?
They still do that. And there's still comics. Like, what I love is that there are certain comics who are fucking cowards, because I have discovered that there are a lot more comedians doing material about trans people than I've ever seen. Right. There are so many of them. Right. It's like, oh, you just don't do it when I'm on a bill with you, do you? Right, okay. That says a lot about it.
So, I mean, I think, you know, I've forgotten her name. There was a trans comedian when I first started in the
Shelley Cooper.
Shelley Cooper, yeah. And that was, you know, I'd just come up to London and from Somerset, and this was like, oh my goodness, this is, you know, this is an amazing thing.
Well, it's really difficult. It's a difficult thing to try and remember what it was like, even 10 years ago. Yeah. Like, let alone like 20 years ago when I first came out, I didn't know of any. Like, strangely enough, one of my school friends was also trans and had come out when they were a teenager. They'd had like a nervous breakdown when they were about 12 years old and had ended up going through all sorts of therapy to talk to somebody and had come out as trans when they were a teenager, and so got bullied so horrifically that just made me go, right, well, I obviously can't ever let anybody know. And it was like watching somebody else live the life that's like, so that it's, my choice is either be miserable as I am or have a life as awful as hers was, and to realize, as I, you know, that there weren't, like, because I didn't know that there were other trans people that existed anywhere else, you know, I wasn't entirely sure of that. And, you know, and I eventually, like, when I was 17, I spoke to my GP. And that was the last thing she was expecting of a Tuesday morning in a village of 200 people in the late 90s. Dr. France, for the one person who knows who that is in the audience. Hi, Bron. My mate Bron's in the audience. We've been friends since we were 11, haven't we? Yeah, we went to school together. And both now work in comedy. Yeah. I don't know why that's anything, really. But I remember going and chatting to my GP, and she sort of like went and did loads of research, was like really, really great about it, and got me to go and see, I went to go and see a psychiatrist at the local hospital, who was the first person to use correct pronouns when talking about me in anything. And that was just like a massive weight off my mind. It was like, oh God, because as a child, like, you spend so much time worrying that you're weird, and you are. It doesn't matter who you are, you're a fucking weird, because you're a kid. Kids are weird. But you're not weird for the things that you think you're weird about. And thinking that you're, you know, insane, which is, you know, a legal term rather than a medical one. But yeah, then talking to this psychiatrist who then did that, and that just made me... That was, like, such a relief for the first time. I was like, actually, this is something that... This feels right. Unfortunately, shortly after that, he committed suicide, so I had to be reassessed. Because, again, unluckiest person you've ever met. I know my psychiatrist's suicide isn't really about me, but... yeah, and... Yeah, and so it was really... And I remember shortly after I came out to my parents that there was, like, there's a local, like... It wasn't even a local group. There's a group called GIRES, which is Gender Identity Research and Education Society, who had a meeting at one of the pubs in the gay village that was run by Julia Grant, who was famously in the documentary in the 70s and 80s, yes. A Change of Sex, which was, like, the first thing that lots of people had ever heard about transsexuals, as we were called then. And they had this meeting there, and I was like, right, my parents had like gone, we need to know about this, so we need to take you, we need to be as supportive as we can. And so I was the only person who turned up at this thing with like three generations of the family with them. I was like, oh God, right, okay. It was just like, really, and it was the first time I'd met other trans people in real life. And of course, the internet has changed so much of that,
yeah.
In that it's meant that more of us are able to actually talk to each other and be able to interact with each other and find out that there are other people like us, and it makes the world a hell of a lot less lonely. But with that...
Yeah, well, I was going to say, it seems like, you know, when you, in some ways you compare things to 20 years ago, wow, the world's moved on so far, yeah. But then the downside of it is also, like, much worse as well, or is that true, do you think?
I think it is, it can be, and there are ways to avoid it. What I've learned, because I... have but a part of the various things like with the ADHD and that is that I have really extreme rejection sensitivity, which is a really strange thing to do if you're a comedian, yeah. Which means when I die it really fucking hurts more than like soul destroying, and I find it really really difficult to sort of to cope with a lot of the combative side of that. And it was only recently realizing, like, it was after I got clean and sober again as well, drug addict and recovering alcoholic, I got everything. It's like super top trumps. With the Rahalastapa top trumps. Hey! One person! Fucking the rest of you, you've disappointed me and you've made Richard cry.
I'm glad you can do it in the middle of a, you know, a very moving life. That's very important.
That's exactly when you should be doing it. Yeah, what was I talking about? Oh, ADHD? No. I can't even fucking remember what I was talking about. Was anyone listening?
Yeah. We were talking about everything. When you'd gone into saying...
I'd gone into drugs,
but you were talking about going...
Oh, yeah, no, how things have changed. Yeah, yeah, yes, and how things... To us, how I do... I really struggle with the combative nature of things like Twitter and that, especially when people start to be really, really horrible, because I can't help but take it personally. And people go, oh, grow a thicker skin. I can't. Like, it's a genuine psychological condition that means that I can't. I really, really struggle with that. So I've had to reach the point where I just don't argue with people anymore. I just don't. I don't engage in any way.
And I think it's sensible. I mean, I had one day when Sam Smith, you know, came out as gender fluid and saying, surely use the pronouns of people that they want to use. That seems light.
Yeah.
And I got a lot of shit that day just for saying that, what I thought was quite a reasonable comment.
Yeah, you would, because the second that you say something like that, suddenly you are trying to force everybody to be chased into toilets and have people watching you pee. Close the fucking door. I mean, that is literally all you need to do.
It did seem to, from that comment to they're trying to get into the toilets, was very fast, and then that became the obsession for most of the day.
They're so
and
obsessed.
You can go into like the opposite gender's toilets without having to mess around with your own genitals.
Yeah, yeah. Do you know what?
If, just walk in if you want, if you're really that bothered about having a look.
I honestly don't understand this, because statistically, surely you're far more likely to be attacked in a women's toilets by a member of Girls Aloud. I mean, that's just numbers. That's maths. Can't argue with that. But that's where they keep going with that. And that's one of the things that makes it difficult to go out, because on top of that, it's not just when they're talking about stuff like that, because it's not just trans women who then go and reach the brunt of it. It's also cisgender butch women. As well, like, I mean, I'm trans and butch because I'm just lazy, and people always do that. What's the point? I really hate cock. Shown more of a commitment to most lesbians to hating cock. Yeah. This is fun.
It is fun, yeah. Well, sure.
We should record this.
We should. One day we'll do that. It's interesting to talk about, and I think it's a subject that people... I mean, I understand why people are scared about talking about it.
Yeah.
Either way, if you want to question things about it, or if you want to show support for it,
yeah,
you get shit from different people each time.
And I think partly that comes down to so many people arguing in bad faith when it comes down to stuff like that, because genuinely, most of the time, it's people who either want to catastrophize an outcome that's never going to happen,
yeah,
or is going to happen so rarely that it's statistically insignificant compared to the amount of good that it
sure.
does. And so it does become difficult. It does become difficult, especially when you're someone who has to keep fighting that battle every single day. And some days it's, you know, sometimes it's gone. Some days I've like really struggled with it and I've lashed out and then ended up in a fight online. And that never ends well, because that normally ends with me having to block another thousand people who go, "Why are you getting so upset, fella? Why don't you just calm down, mate?" And you're just like, "Oh, fuck off." You know, and people trying to drag up all sorts of horrible like things from my past, or, you know, I regularly get people telling me that if you're so depressed, then you probably should kill yourself. You should go and fill in that, you know, you should become one of the 43% is the thing that they did. Because there was a statistic that I think it was Scottish trans organisation figured out that 43% of, I think it was over 50% of trans people have attempted suicide, and the 43% of people, after they've transitioned, attempt to. And you know, I'm one of that percentage. That was before I came out. That was where I'd ended up having to get pushed to the point where I was just like, I can't carry on living this life anymore. And the fear of if I come out, that my parents, not only would my parents reject me, but it would hurt them more for me to be alive and trans than to be dead. And so I tried to hang myself and tied my cord from my dressing gown around my light fitting in my bedroom and stepped off a chair and realised I probably should have done it before I put on 6 stones through comfort eating and dragged an entire light fitting down and just hit the ground and twisted my ankle. Again, the unluckiest person you've ever... I once tried to gas myself in my car as well about 3 weeks after that, because I was trying pretty frequently to kill myself at that point, and found a spot in the woods where there was already... When I picked out the perfect spot, drove off to the woods, discovered that someone had already parked there. They weren't ending it. And so I drove off to try and find somewhere else and drove around for about an hour and a half and ran out of petrol. And then had to walk like home. I think it was like 10 miles from home at that point. It's like, for fuck's sake, this has extended my life, if anything. you know, and yeah, it was like, yeah, I.
Because it's so bizarre that someone would know that statistic and then not, you know, use it as a weapon rather than think, oh, maybe I should.
Yeah,
maybe I shouldn't be a cunt to this person.
Yeah.
If there's a 50-50 chance of them actually killing themselves.
There's a 50-50 chance of them actually killing themselves. And in my opinion, the world would be a safer place without them in it. It's how they think. And it's that thing that they think that they're right and they think that what they're doing is safe and they think that what they're doing is going to make the world a safer place. And my view is that it doesn't, on account of I'm one of the people who's lived through it, and I really struggle on a daily basis because of a lot of the stuff that's been said about that. And so far, I've harmed fewer people than members of Girls Aloud have. I think. Yeah. I'm fairly sure. I mean, I was trying to think, because you were asking, I remember you saying if there are any celebrities that have injured, and I think I gave Susie Quattro swine flu. But other than that, I can't really think of anything. So, you know, if Susie Quattro is listening,
yeah,
which I assume she is.
She will be, yeah.
She will be, yeah. She's a big fan.
She's always bothering me to try and get
on. She is. Yeah, yeah.
Well, yeah, it's, you know, it's, I mean, it's great that comedy can be used to discuss these subjects and define the comedy in all these subjects. I mean, you know, like you say, there's the addictions you've had as well and the...
Oh, I was really good at that.
Yeah.
really good
but
at
it's,
that.
But, you know, I think it all these things need to be talked about, and comedy is the best way to talk about them, I think.
I think it is, because everything that we do with fun. Because if you, like, I always think that, like, laughing is the moment when, I can't remember who said it, but laughing is the moment when you forget you're going to die. That's what it is. It's you laughing because you're like, I'm here. That's, you are absolutely in the moment. And I think talking about things that are really important, you can actually get across a really, really good message with that. And if you can make people laugh along the way, because so many of the horrible things that happen to us, we find hilarious anyway.
Yeah.
The amount of times you'll be in the middle of, like, something that's really, really, like, especially if you're a if you've got a comedian's brain, if you're thinking jokes when you're in the middle of a really, really horrible situation, you're going, oh, this is going to be so funny at some point. It's going to be so funny one day. Like when I broke my leg and I was like lying there in agony on the floor in the middle of this leisure centre. We were doing roller derby and I was, obviously. And somebody kicked my foot and I got my foot caught behind my heel and twisted my foot 180 degrees and like double spiral fracture to my tibia and fibula. And I was lying there with my foot pointing in the wrong direction whilst people are skating around. And I was in absolute agony. And initially, you get like that rush of endorphins and you get a bit high and you're a bit daft. And then I started going into pain. And my friend Danny, who was our team medic, came over and she was like next to me. She went, listen, it's okay. When you break something, you get like a rush of endorphins, like the body's natural painkillers. After about 20 minutes, they start to go away and you might go into shock. That's what's happening now, but don't worry. There's a really easy way to get the endorphins going again. And I was like, anything. And she went, masturbate. I was like, you fucking what? I'm in a leisure centre on a Sunday afternoon with a broken leg with people skating around me. Fuck it, chuck a coat over me, I'll give it a go. And it's really difficult because you can't point your toes, that's the main thing. But in the time when that was happening, I was lying there going, this will be hilarious at some point.
I mean, that's definitely the comedian's instinct. Yeah. I think also with comedy as well, if you can make people laugh about something, and even if they disagree with you or if they've got a prejudice against you, then it, you know, if they're not viewing you as the same as them or not viewing you as human, you know, that it humanizes.
Absolutely agree with that. Yeah, because there's so many times that I do that. And because almost all of my... I don't often talk about being trans on stage. I don't talk about being trans on stage as often as I would like. Like most Friday and Saturday night gigs, I struggle with it just because when I do mention it, it's like I don't... None of the bits that I have about it are short and snappy enough to really go into a club set 20. I really need to sort of like go into more depth. Or give them more perspective, because like, if I go up there on stage and go, hello, so, let's talk about being transgender, shall we? An audience just like, hey, what? No, because first of all, I know I don't look like they expect a comedian to look like, and I don't sound like they expect a comedian to sound like, and I think when they hear the name Bethany Black, they don't immediately assume that I'll look like this. So when I get up on stage, what I've started to do is not even mention that I'm a lesbian until about 5 minutes into it, because that makes them awkward as well. And then I reference that it's made them awkward because you can see them about 5 minutes in if I don't mention it going, does she know? I mean, I can tell, but does she know? I don't want to be the one to tell her. And it's lovely to see people doing that. But I do talk about those sorts of things on stage. And it's a way of bringing, you know, things that people haven't really had much experience of and showing that there are similarities and differences, but that, you know, the things that we can find funny, we can all find funny.
Yeah.
You know, without it having to be, like, horrible. Because that's the thing, because there are so many comedians out there who go, oh, you can't joke about anything anymore. You can. Don't be a cunt. Literally, that is all. Don't be boring. Don't do jokes that everyone's already done. That's pretty much it, really. There are so many jokes that you can tell, and people choose not to. And they instead decide to go down the same old route that they've done like 1,000 times before, where they'll just, you know, especially when it comes to trans stuff, where they get halfway through and go, oh, I've not been this confused since I was last in Thailand. They're like, oh, you prick.
When audiences, and if you do talk about it, do you get heckled by audiences, or are they, because in person, that's interesting, isn't it?
In person, no, they never do. Yeah. They never do. Some people, you can see them getting really angry and uncomfortable, right. And obviously those are the ones I then deliver the rest of the material directly to. as far as possible, walk over to them and just talk right into their faces with it until, yeah. But no, people, like that, because I think that was the thing that I was really worried about when I first started talking about it on stage, was that I'd get heckled. And the thing is, not a single thing that anyone has ever heckled, and I say this, this is absolutely true, I say this on stage now, not a single thing that anyone has ever heckled me with in 18 years of doing stand-up has been anywhere near as upsetting as the sort of thing that my mum would say just during the average 15-minute phone conversation. Genuinely. And the example I give of that was about a year ago. It was one of the most pure examples of that. I was on the phone to her, and whilst I was talking to her, I banged my knee. And she went, "Are you all right?" I went, "Yeah, I banged my knee." And she went, "Yeah, you do need to lose weight." I love my mum. She's fucking wonderful. When I came out to my mum as trans, her response was, "But we've just had a conservatory built." And she's wonderful. She's lovely. And I love her to pieces, because this was it, because I was talking to her about this, because I said to her and my dad, 'cause I've been a big fan of yours since I was little. I've got all of, like, apart from the DVDs that you're selling tonight, which I'm going to buy, and the rest of you do as well, I've got all of your DVDs, so this was as much a sort of like, I was super excited about doing this. And I said to my parents, like, I'm doing the Richard Daring Leicester Square Theatre podcast, or whatever, the Roy Hood Language School podcast. And I said, you know, I'm dead excited about it. Do you want to come? And they went, yeah, we might do. And it's really, it's a really, really big deal for me. Like, oh, yeah. We've got an opportunity to go to a caravan in Kendall for the weekend. So, all right, okay. So they're in Kendall right now, enjoying themselves. And I spoke to my mum this morning, because she said, like, I listened to the Dawn French one. And I said, oh, right, what did you think? She goes, well, he'll go on and he'll say some funny things, and then he'll introduce you, and then you'll talk for a bit, and if you go off track, he'll guide you, so it should be easy. And I was like, that was it, was it? Yeah, that was everything.
She's got my number.
Yeah, she has. She knows. She does. She knows you very, very well. But yeah, that was, yeah. I don't even know why I started telling that.
Well, it's about being heckled and stuff. Yeah. But, you know, it's really great to have an opportunity to talk to you about all that. But I also sort of think we shouldn't have to as well, you know. But that's the difficulty with all of these.
Well, it's that
subjects,
thing. It's like,
you know?
Yeah, you go, oh, do you know? Yeah, it's that thing of like, we didn't, and now suddenly it's like, well, yeah, we've got a lot of catching up to do. Because for a lot of people, because this is the thing, like the amount of times I've seen people online going, oh, it's all new, isn't it? Suddenly all these trans people turning up. Where have they all come from? I'm like, well, we've always been here. Like, we've been among you for as long as there have been people. There have been trans people in your toilets for as long as there have been toilets. You know, we're not like fucking spiders, you know. You go, oh, glass over the top, take them outside. No, it's like we have been as part of society for as long as there's been society. We've existed, and the thing is that now more people are able to talk to each other, and more people are able to go, actually, I don't really fit in along this idea. And I think that that's a good thing. I think that's the thing that we're opening up, and we're able to go, do you know what, I struggle with things, I have difficulty, because that's like the core of almost all mental illnesses. I struggle with things, and I need a way to be able to get around it. But so much of the stuff is caused by external factors. You know, it's like, this is because I've been working really hard with a psychotherapist for the last 6 months, and she's been really fucking good. And she's really not used to dealing with people who are autistic and problem-solving focused. Because she went, oh, I think maybe you should do this. And most people go away going, I'm not doing what she tells me. Whereas I go away and come back and go, I did exactly what you told me. And it turns out my life's perfect now. So if anything, I'm too mentally healthy. And it's, yeah, and so much that I've realised is just people not recognising that you've got to talk about stuff. It's about saying to other people, these things make me feel uncomfortable and I want to feel comfortable, because we all deserve to feel comfortable, don't we?
And everyone's got something, you know. It might not be 15 things all at once, like it is for you, but everyone's got something. And hearing people talk about that, at least you go, oh, they can talk about that and I can talk about and, you know, and I think if you could talk about all of these things, it's enormous, because, you know, a lot of people think, Mike, if that was me, or if I had two of those things, I'd be
in a much worse state. I've only got... oh, well, you're all lucky to have had me here tonight.
There you are.
I hope
yeah.
you realise that.
They certainly are. Right, let's ask you a couple of emergency questions, then we'll go and have a drink.
Let's do it. Yeah.
I've got some new... Who is the most famous person that you've ever been in a lift with that you didn't get into the lift with? I mean, you know, that you weren't
with. Yeah, that wasn't with at the time.
Might not be anyone. It's a tricky question.
That is a tricky question, because I'm just trying to think. Andrew Hayden Smith.
Okay.
Who was also in Doctor Who.
Okay.
But who was in a different episode of Doctor Who from me. But, I think that...
Who's Moriarty?
I think he's in Hollyoaks now. And he was in The Rise of the Cybermen.
Okay.
The David Tennant Cybermen story.
What did he do in the lift? Did he do anything interesting in the lift?
No, nothing interesting in the lift. He was a boring lift compatriot.
Well, at least we've learned that about him.
Yeah.
If you could have...
trust him in a lift.
I mean, I think the TARDIS counts as a kind of lift.
Yeah.
I'm quite excited that they've got they said, you want to see my TARDIS? Do you think they think... That they really, I mean, are they really TARDISes?
Yeah, I think they really are.
Do you want to have a go on my TARDIS?
Well, we did, because we had a go and we went back, and you won't know this, but until 2015, England never won the World Cup in 66. So, you know, we went back and we did that. That was what we did with that afternoon on the TARDIS.
Brilliant. If you could have any one item from any art gallery or museum in the world to keep, all the art galleries and museums say, we're going to give you one thing and it's yours. What would it be? It can be a work of art, or it can be an item that you fancy having from a...
I mean, the velvet rope that they have around the that they have around stuff. Yeah. I'd like some of that for my house.
You can probably get that.
I can probably get that.
I bet you would get it for free.
Yeah.
I mean, if you chose an expensive painting, you could sell that and get a lot of velvet rope. Though.
Yeah, I could. Yeah, if I got the Mona Lisa, I could go and draw a hat on it and then sell it. I think she'd look good in a hat.
Yeah.
I think that's what's missing from that. Actually, do you know what? Which one I'd go for?
What?
I'd go for a piece of artwork by Coolidge called A Bold Bluff.
Okay.
Which is more often known as The Dogs Playing Poker.
Okay.
It's the original of that. That's the one I'd want.
Okay, that's a good choice. I think that'd be a very nice thing to
have. So then I could go and make it into an even better artwork by cutting it in half and putting it in two jugs of formaldehyde. Like a Damien Hirst. Combine the two greatest artists of all time.
I've kind of got to ask you about a time-travelling finger, Doctor Who so much. So if your finger could travel through time, where would it go and what would it get up to?
Just thinking of all the people I could poke in the eye.
Yeah, or anywhere.
Oh, God, I don't know. Where would I go? Oh, I'd go back and flick Hitler, I think.
Yeah. It's a popular choice for choosing the same hairstyle as you.
Yeah, that's exactly mine.
Well, look, it's you are a fantastic stand-up comedian and actor, I have to say. Is there more stuff on the way with acting? Have you got more acting
jobs? I've not got any more acting that's coming out at the moment because I'm over 40. And so as a result, everyone went, I got loads and loads of them, and I was turning things down and going, oh, I'm not doing that. And then I got to 40 and I got three auditions last year and went, I'm sure I'll be taking a show out on the road somewhere, and I'm currently writing stuff as well. I've been asked to write my memoir
because
my agent went, we've got someone in our books department to come and to have a chat with. And I went in, she went, I've been told I need to listen to your life story. And I went, all right then. And then started telling it. And about 5 minutes in, you could see pound signs appear in her eyes before her jaw hit her chest. She was like, your life has been shit. Oh, we're going to get so rich.
Well, that's good. I hope you do.
I fucking hope so.
Because I'm not lending you any money to get bankrupt again. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a massive round of applause, Bethany Black. Thank you very much. Thank you for coming. I'll see you up in the bar. You have been listening to Rahulastapa with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Bethany Black. Thank you to Pest for providing the music. Thank you to everyone at the lovely Stoller Hall, Manchester, for having us along. Thank you to Chris Evans, not that one. Thank you to all the camera crews who have come along with us to this tour, and to the George the Incompetent Sound Man who's come to some of them as well. I am indebted to my series producer, Ben Walker.
Also to my executive producer for this show, who was Alex Pinkney. We called them Alex Pinkney behind their back. It was very funny because they're named Pinkney, but we called them Pinkney like they had a pink knee. But one time they showed their knee, and they did have one really pink knee, and then we felt bad because we'd been mocking their pink knee. We didn't realise they had one. Anyway, this is a FuzzGoFasterStripe.com and Sky Potato production. Head to richardherring.com/gigs or richardherring.com/rahalastapata/tour, and you can find out all the upcoming live shows in London, and there's some sold out ones. We're going to be at the Edinburgh Fringe, we're going to be doing more in the Leicester Square Theatre in September and October, and hopefully a few more around the country in 2020. Check it out, biatches, you know you want to.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Thanks for listening. richardherring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.